Welcome to the Listening Podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Tay.
And I'm your co-host, Nick Bell. Now, we get down and dirty with world-leading business minds. And to top it off, nothing is off limits.
Just please make sure you keep your clothes on.
Now, I can't promise that.
And on today's episode, we catch up with our friend and the co-founder of Netflix, Mark Randall. We have an amazing guest for you today. I'm super, super excited to talk to this amazing, amazing entrepreneur. He's, I would say, easily one of the most successful entrepreneurs of our generation. And we've actually had a chat to him before, so we're going to go a little bit further under the covers with him today. But he's the author of That Will Never Work, and that is easily one of my most favorite business books of all time. He's a big fan of Biggie Smalls, which I was
surprised. I wouldn't have picked that. I would not have picked that one.
Yeah. And we're very lucky to have him actually just come back from a break to have a chat to us. And I really wanted to have a chat to him about a video that I saw on his LinkedIn, which shows some bears trying to break into the cabin. So welcome to Under the Covers, Mark Randolph, the co-founder of Netflix.
At least it's a pleasure to be with you under the covers. Thanks for thanks for having me.
It's a scary place to be, but
dark.
Now, before we get into this, I think Mark's wearing shorts today. He's got a business shirt on top and shorts down below. I've got I've got trackies on as well. Lisa, what are you wearing?
I'm wearing a dress.
You're the professional one. There we go. Well, mate, thanks for joining us. Now, you've taken August off. Mate, what have you been up to for the past month or two?
Well, so, you know, for the most part, I'm not doing a lot. I have a bunch of companies that I'm working with, and so I'm spending time trying to help them navigate through some of these COVID waters. Although it feels like now that we're kind of coming out the other side, at least business-wise. I took the month of August off, as you mentioned, which was not completely off, but enough to kind of recharge. It always helps to have a moment where you step back and make sure that you're going in the direction you want to. Yeah. Now I'm digging back in again. Got lots of stuff I want to try and get done.
Back into the game. Have you found that COVID has definitely impacted most of your businesses negatively or positively in the past few months?
No, it's kind of funny. I would say some of them it's been disastrous and some of them it's been phenomenally good. And it largely depends upon what category you're in. I mean, for example, one of the companies that I'm entering is they're making a robotic dishwasher. Which is, you know, it's, so I don't picture like a robot, you know, with a little skirt on that's kind of, you know, doing dishes in the, not an apron, doing dishes in the sink. It's a machine that kind of sits in a restaurant that you load it up. It loads up the little rack and slides it into the big sterilizing machine.
Right.
But it's for big companies. It's for big corporate cafeterias, for hotels, for catering companies. And their business has been decimated.
Mm. Yeah.
Because obviously there are no people eating in corporate cafeterias. There are no people eating in hotel banquet rooms. There are no big weddings. So that's been terrible for them. And they're scrambling, trying to figure out how do you pivot into something that works better. But on the other end of the spectrum, one of the companies I work with is, we were talking about shorts a moment ago.
Chubby's
Shorts. And they're a company which is a direct-to-consumer company. We know they sell on the internet. They sell shorts. And while they did have stores and some wholesale business, which went to zero, the fact that they'd spent, 8 years really mastering how to sell over the internet has come in handy now when essentially the only way people want to buy things is over the internet. Yeah. And so their business is better than it's ever been. It just goes to show you can't really tell until you see it.
I'm definitely going to buy some Chubby shorts after this conversation today.
But you know, in the United States, Chubby's makes short shorts for men.
Oh, perfect.
In other words,
don't give
me show my skinny legs off.
Yeah, it's not for everybody. But listen, you know, the short shorts went out of style, were big back in the 60s and 70s in the United States, and then they were gone during the era of the cargo shorts. But in Australia, I happen to know, they've never gone out of style. I mean, you know, you guys know that I watch a lot of footy.
Yeah.
And you see these, you know, incredibly athletic men running around in these teeny short little shorts. So it's in Australia. It's going to do great there.
Oh, my God. So are they that short?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I can't do the translation really quickly. It's a 5-inch inseam. So what's that, 50 centimeter? You know, that's how long the inseam is. It's really short.
That, we do not want to see Nick in those, so please do not send him
from my shot. It does say, what does, you know, reinforce gym membership, you know.
Oh my God. So what actually made you invest in shorts? Like, how do you make a decision? Because obviously, I thought you did more tech stuff. So I'd be interested to know why this particular company was of interest to you.
So it's different. Yeah, I'm not an investor in them. I've been mentoring the founders now for 6+ years. Oh. And it's because the criteria that I use for picking who I want to mentor, who I want to work with, is very, very different than who I might choose to invest in, or somewhat different. Because when I'm mentoring, my criteria is, A, do I like these people? Am I going to enjoy spending time with them? Am I going to be upset when they call me at 11 o'clock at night with a problem? And if the answer is yes, I don't want to be involved with that. And so the first thing is, I liked these founders. The second thing was a really interesting problem, because there was four of them, which is extremely unusual, because most of the time the teams I work with are two people, which is kind of a stable startup environment. So the fact that there was four founders and they had not yet made any clear delineation about who was CEO, who was marketing, they were all co-CEO. This has got to be an interesting company to help. And the last thing is, their marketing was unbelievably good. So genuine, so honest, so funny, so irreverent, that I was immediately drawn to them. And so you see, the reason I choose to mentor a company is very selfish. I just have a good time with it.
Enjoy it.
Whereas even these days, the companies I choose to invest in, it used to be I tried to make money, and I realized how lame I am at that. And so now I go, I can't figure out who's going to make money and not make money. So now I invest largely on the same grounds, which is, do I like this person? And do I want to see them have a shot?
So when you invest in companies, what do you look for? Is it pre-revenue? Is it, do you look at the financials? Like, what are things you look for before you invest? And is it, do they come with an idea and you invest in the idea, or do they have to have a business that's established? Like, there's so many variables here.
I'm waiting for to see if you actually stumble on the one which it actually is.
You like the founders?
Yes. Do I like the founders?
Yeah.
And it's not just, do I like the founders? Because even if I was investing to try it with the explicit intention of making a return, I'd be betting on the founders. Because don't forget, I haven't told you, but the companies that I really like investing in are early stage companies.
Yeah.
I mean, startups. So these are not companies with a 7 or 8 year track record where I can look at their revenues and their all their metrics. They're very early. They're in their first year or two of being in business. And the reality is, you just can't tell. It's too early.
It's gambling.
And so the only thing you can bet on is, does this founder or founders have the creativity, the cleverness, the persistence to stick with this, to keep maneuvering, to keep digging in and trying until they finally land on something that works. And when you find that, that's what I like to back.
I've been a little bit burnt by investing in startups over the years. I've done about 25, 30 investments, and I've just been absolutely fried in terms of, and I'm losing faith, and I'm trying not to lose faith. Mark, how many, out of all the investments, like, what's your win ratio?
It's terrible. I'm a terrible angel investor. I mean, so don't feel bad. But it's really, really hard. And I have huge advantages over you in that my deal flow is really good. And I can get myself into rounds that are oversubscribed or where they're not taking any money, but they kind of want my name as part of the investor pool. So I'll take advantage of that. But even with that, I have a very, very poor hit rate. And it's purely because I get overly enthusiastic. I kind of fall in love with these ideas.
Yeah.
I still approach the world as an entrepreneur, which is with this incredible boundless optimism that no matter how hard this problem is, it is solvable, which is what allows an entrepreneur to keep going. Whereas the good investors come at it from the opposite perspective, which is, oh, this is awful. Everything is broken. It's never going to work. In other words, a horribly cynical perspective, which allows them to really see through the founder's reality distortion field, and hopefully get to the bottom of it. So I've given up. I no longer invest with the expectation of making a return. I now invest because I really want to have this front row seat watching them solve problems. And that's a really exciting thing to be. And listen, if I do make money, well, even better. I hadn't expected that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Oh, sorry, guys.
Sorry, Liz, one's questions. So from what I gather, you don't really care for money too much. You enjoy the process and building something. So do you invest, or is it purely just you enjoy it?
Well, you know, obviously it's like, look at the rich guy who's like, I don't care about the money in the investment. I recognize I'm remarkably fortunate in that, you know, obviously Netflix did really well, and Looker, which more most recent company, did really well. So yeah, but it's more that was never what the motivation was. I never did things because I wanted to be wealthy or because I wanted something. I was always about pursuing these really interesting challenges. And in my startup career, I actually have a really good track record. Whereas my investment career is the one where it's disastrous. In my startups, most of them have made money. Only one of them was a complete disaster. But that's because I never set out with the intention of them being economically successful. I set out to try and solve what I thought was a really interesting problem in each case. And that turns out to be, for me, a much, much better motivator to keep going. Because then, I mean, you only really make huge money on a startup once if you're extremely lucky. But you get to solve interesting problems every single day. That's a much better reason to come to work, in my opinion.
Mate, this is a little bit off topic. I read recently that Jeff Bezos or Amazon tried to buy Netflix for $12 million very, very early on. Obviously, it's worked out for everyone. What happened there, and where do you think Amazon, this is another topic, is going to go? Do you think Amazon's going to continue to be an absolute juggernaut, or do you think it's going to kind of finish up one day? Or not finish up, but not continue to grow the rate it's growing?
So the first story is that Amazon was interested in us very, very early. Yeah. In other words, within 3 to 4 months of us launching the company.
Oh, wow.
This was in 1998, to put it in perspective, so 22 years ago. And Amazon at the time was only in books, if you can imagine that. All they sold was books. Yeah. But they had made no secret that they were eventually going to be the everything store. And we knew that eventually they would do video and music. And so here we were 3 months into it, and Amazon calls and says, we want to see you. And so when Reed Hastings, my co-founder, and I flew up to Seattle to visit Jeff Bezos, we knew that most likely that's what this was about, that he wanted to jumpstart his entry into video and was basically gonna consider acquiring us to gain the people, maybe the technology that would allow him to do it faster. And on one hand, this was incredibly exciting. You know, as I hope you know, I know you know, hope your audience knows that my book is called That Will Never Work. And the reason it's called That Will Never Work is because that is what every single person said who we told that idea to, including my wife. So you take this idea, which everybody thought was a disaster, everyone thought would never work, and all of a sudden, here is Jeff Bezos, the pioneer of e-commerce, saying, I see something in you guys. So on one hand, we're going, this is awesome. And considering we thought it probably would have been in this $10 to $15 million range, that would have been a really nice exit for someone who'd been working on this for less than 12 months.
Right.
But at that time, Reed and I mistakenly thought we've already solved all the hard problems. We've managed to build a working website. We've managed to source every single DVD available, because in the United States for the first 10 years, Netflix was DVDs by mail.
Yes.
And we figured we've got this solved. And so even though selling to Amazon would have been a nice exit, we weren't quite ready at that point to give it up. So for Reed and I think this was more of a commitment ceremony, in that we kind of had to look each other in the eye and say, wow, we can get out if we want. Are we in? And the answer, of course, was yes, we're in. And, you know, Amazon, to the second question, I have tremendous respect for Amazon. Ever since pre-public, I've seen what Jeff Bezos was doing and had admiration at every step. You know, I was a direct marketing person, a junk mail king, a catalog guy, magazine circulation.
Oh, you're that guy.
I was that guy. polyester suit and all.
Oh, spam in my letterbox.
All those signs you see on every single house in Melbourne, that was because of me. But because of that, when I saw the internet come along, the first thing that jumped into my mind was, oh my gosh, this is how to sell things on a direct sales basis, on a direct marketing basis. This is direct marketing on steroids. And so when I saw Jeff Bezos selling books, I went, wow, he is actually doing it and doing it brilliantly.
Yeah.
And at every stage, when he announced, told his investors, do not invest in this company if you're expecting an immediate return. We are in this for the long term. Mm. Fantastic. And then making the bets he did, always saying, I'm not going to make a profit because there's better to invest that money forward.
Yeah.
It's incredible. What a story.
AWS, oh, it's incredible what he's built. It's unbelievable.
Sure. If you had said, okay, here's this bookstore, or even jump a few years later, here's this everything store. Now, let's now pick someday, 10 years in the future, someone is going to be the pioneer and dominant market share leader in cloud computing. Mm. Let's see, is it going to be Oracle? Is it going to be Microsoft? Is it going to be Salesforce? Who's it going to be? Man, you never would have picked Amazon.
Yeah.
Or in the United States, I'm not sure they have this yet in Australia, but you know, for years you've had the grocery stores, the supermarkets, going, oh, we're immune. You know, no one's can e-commerce this away from us because it's fresh vegetables and fresh milk. We're not threatened. And at the same time, this unbelievably terrible user experience of going shopping and standing at the checkout. And someone came along and said, well, let's reinvent the grocery store. And all of a sudden, who is that? Amazon. Yes. So those guys have nothing to complain about. They had plenty of warning and they spent 20 years doing nothing. And now they're going to have their, no pun intended, their lunch handed to them.
It's really Bezos and Elon Musk, isn't it? Look at what Elon's doing. Incredible.
Yeah, in a different way. Elon's incredibly, I can't believe it, but you know, most people, my big thing, as you've heard, is focus. You know, I really believe you pick the thing that's most important and you spend all your time getting that right. Yeah. It's hard enough getting one thing right. And here's someone who goes, no, I can do cars, I can do batteries, I can do solar panels, I can do rockets, I can do drilling machines, I can do brain implants.
Yeah, yeah.
And then does.
And does it. But I think he's a PR machine. Like he uses the media amazingly well. And look at his share price. Now he's the third richest man in the world because of Tesla. It's incredible what he's done.
It is incredible.
Do you think it's actually really important that you've got someone, like say you're looking at investing or you're looking to help people in companies, that it's important to have someone that is really marketable? Because like Nick was saying, he's done so well because he's such an out there personality and he's literally just clickbait. Look at all the crazy stuff that he's done, like the name that he named his kid. I can't even, some weird formula or something. So do you think it really helps having someone who's almost larger than life to lead a company and capture the attention of people?
No, not at all. Seriously. I mean, you work with what you have. And hardly anybody can be like that. I mean, a Steve Jobs can be a showman like that.
Yep.
You know, Elon Musk can be a showman like that. But Jeff Bezos is not a showman like that. Mm. Certainly, you know, Larry and Sergey from Google are definitely not showmen like that. They're geeks. And Mark Zuckerberg is a geek. It's not a necessary ingredient, but the smart entrepreneurs take whatever skill that they have and recognize their strengths and their weaknesses and use their strengths and their weaknesses as they're appropriate. Yeah. So I do have one founder I work with who is, he is a hustler. He can sell like crazy. He can make you believe anything, but he's a terrible manager. And it took him a while to realize that. And now that he's realized it, he can put himself in a position where he can do these tasks which are suited to that. and stay out of the way when it comes time to making these strategic decisions or managing people and all those things that he's terrible.
Back to your investments, what are you looking to invest in right now in terms of what trends are you seeing in the market at the moment?
I don't follow the trends. I just don't care that much. I use my investments as learning vehicles because it's the secret, the little secret weapon here, that if you really want someone to teach you a lot about how something works, it helps to be an investor in the company. Mm. And it helps even more if you're on the board. And so I've chosen some of these companies that I mentor and some of the ones I invest in, partly because of some investment premise. That's only a teeny bit. Mostly it's, I'm just curious. I mean, the robotics company was, I really would like to understand more about what's going on with robotics. What is state of the art? What are the issues? What are the challenges? I'm mentoring an AI company for the same reason. Hmm. I didn't know anything about AI before, and now I'm actually reasonably fluent about things like that. But it came, that's what drives the investment. So it's founder first, and then I'll get dragged into the technology afterwards. Like if you ask me about, you know, Bitcoin, I haven't the slightest idea. Lame. Don't know anything about that. One of these days, I will end up finding an entrepreneur who's doing something interesting, and I'll jump on just for that. And then in 2 years, when we talk, I'll know all about blockchain and finance. And
what a great way to learn.
We actually interviewed Robert Kiyosaki recently, and Robert said he only invests in Bitcoin, gold, and silver. That's it. Doesn't touch anything else. Yeah,
that's well, there's a premise that says you only invest in things you understand.
Yeah.
And the things you can really deeply understand are actually pretty limited. So that's not a bad premise. But you got to point out the obvious. He probably is doing it because he tries to make a return on it. Yeah. Whereas any advice you get from me is going to be advice on how to lose all your money. So do the opposite.
Obviously, you're mentoring and investing in other companies. Do you think you'll have one last hurrah and build another Netflix or something just as sizable?
Never. But I will point out that 7 years ago when Lloyd Tabb and asked me to mentor him launching Looker, I said never. And then got sucked in. Yeah. But I'm smarter now. So I have better defenses against being lured into the startup world. I like the balance that I have now, and I'm going to try and hold on to that.
Can I ask you, who are some of your mentors and who have been some of the people that have really helped you throughout your career?
Well, I've just been exceptionally lucky that I've had the chance to work with and for three brilliant entrepreneurs. And that's three more than I deserved and three more than most people get. And second only to doing it yourself, the best way to learn entrepreneurial skill is to watch closely, not what someone says, but what they do, who's really skilled at it. And the very first, not my very first job, my second or third job, I got hired to help start a magazine for a gentleman named Peter Godfrey, who was a genius and an entrepreneur. And just watching him make decisions and seeing how he spent his day ended up being hugely instructional for me. And then eventually we sold that magazine and then we started a mail order company, but I was running the mail order company. And even then I'd come back and say, here's what I'm doing, here's what I'm struggling with. And he goes, you should try this. Mm. And it'd be a whole new way of thinking about a problem. And it was fantastic. And then another amazing person I worked with is a gentleman named Philippe Kahn, who founded a company named Borland International. And he was a crazy man, but a genius, and just did things completely differently than I'd ever seen anybody do. But I would just watch the way he made decisions and it imprinted on me so deeply. And then a third one, of course, would be Reed, who I was exceptionally lucky to work really closely with. And watch the way he thought and the way he made decisions. And that was much more, that wasn't necessarily me watching him up on a pedestal. I was seeing every day as the two of us solve problems together. But that was even more instructional. So, and I'm gonna keep learning. You know, I still get a chance to work with these brilliant entrepreneurs. I'm still learning what it takes to be good at this game.
Last question from Lisa and I. What do you think is the biggest mistake that startups make in the first 12 to 24 months?
They try to do too much. They have this mistaken belief that to get it right, you have to get everything right. And that's an almost impossible task in a startup, where almost by definition, you have 10 or 20 times more things to do than you have time and people and money to do. Yeah. And the mistake they make is they do them all, and they do each of them halfway. And the real skill is having the ability to recognize that there's two or maybe three things that if you get them right, all the rest will take care of itself. And it's a dual skill. It's the skill to recognize what those two or three things are, and then the equal skill to be able to focus on those, even though other problems are screaming more loudly or the fire is burning even hotter. It's going, I have to get this right. I have to get this right. I have to get this right. But that problem is so frequent that I call it selling the t-shirts, which is people are telling me about their company. And then they go, and just imagine how much money we're going to get selling the branded merchandise. And you know, the t-shirts with their company name on it. And I go, gosh, let's hope that ends up being a problem for you, that you get big enough that anyone cares. And the fact that you're even thinking about that really scares me.
Yeah. I love your nicknames. Was it the shit sandwich as well?
Shit sandwich, Canada Principal. Got a lot of these good ones.
Yeah. Well, I've actually got a few questions from our community. So we put the call out for some questions. So we got a couple of really good ones back. So we'd love to ask some of those.
Some are good. Some are pretty ordinary. So,
oh, that's mean.
No, the ones about who's the best real estate person on this Netflix show?
Selling Sunset.
Come on.
Haven't seen it.
Yeah, I'm I actually asked Lisa, I said, what's that?
Okay, so Andrew Rhodes asks about, obviously you've spoken about how you went to pitch to Blockbuster and they obviously didn't end up investing and buying Netflix. Are you glad that they didn't? Or do you think that you would have been able to take the company in a direction faster or a completely different direction if they had invested?
Wow, that's an incredibly interesting question. And I think about it a lot because you really can see scenarios going in either direction. But to answer the question, my suspicion is you would not be Blockbustering and chill right now. I think the whole thing would have gone away. I think that the corporate forces would have killed the innovation. I think Blockbuster was being driven later to compete by the fact that we were eating their lunch, so to speak, and that without a competitor trying to push them to be more innovative that way, I just don't think they would have put the resources in. I think after about 6 months, Reed and I and pretty much everyone else there who was talented would have left. So my suspicion is that I'm very lucky that they said no.
Yeah, I think everything happens for a reason. I was actually thinking the other day about how I used to go down to the video store and then you know you have to rewind the video before you return it back. So like old school. Okay, so the next question is from, I'm going to absolutely butcher these names, so I do apologize to these people in advance. David Feverliaki. Oh my God, I'm so sorry, David. What's one decision you made that allowed Netflix to grow and one decision that you made that you believe held it back from potentially being bigger success?
Good question.
So there's a lot of, I mean, obviously being successful is never hinges on one thing. So I can't point to, here's one I did and boom, it took off. But I think that one of the principles that I brought to the company was from my direct marketing days. Was really good, that had a culture and a process and a system for trying thousands of bad ideas. And you know, going back to that will never work, it was right, it didn't work. It took us a year and a half of trying hundreds of things before we finally landed on the one weird business model innovation that ended up getting us product market fit and sustaining us until streaming came along, you know, 10 years later. And that's probably the missed decision that I made. And I kick myself for this now, is earlier in our discussion, I was talking about being a junk mail person, a direct marketing person, a magazine circulation person, someone very, very familiar with subscription businesses. But it took me 20 months before I said, maybe we should test this business as a subscription business. And ultimately that is what worked.
Yeah.
There's no due dates, no late fees, subscription. And boom, all of a sudden we were taking off.
That's interesting.
I can't believe that I didn't think about that earlier.
I actually read the book Shoe Dog recently by Phil Knight.
That's good, isn't it?
It's great. Yeah. Great. And they didn't start making money for, I think, 17 years, like money, it's proper money. And so they went through 17 years of growth, but didn't make an absolute cent. And one day it just clicked and all of a sudden, boom, they started making squillions.
Yeah. So, that is a great book for very similar reasons, is that he humanizes the process of being a startup. It's not a glorified thing. And the things that he makes sound great are the things that are great. It's the fun times. It's when you're struggling. It's the cast of misfits. It's very evocative. I leaned very heavily on that book in terms of what kind of inspired me to write mine, with the confidence that, A, you could write a very vulnerable, honest book about a startup that it did not need to be a founder is a genius story. And you could also write about events that took place 20 years in the past, which Shoe Dog, Phil Knight stopped his book right at their IPO, which was, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think it was from 1960 to 1985, I believe, off the top of my head. But yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, I actually really love that book, and I loved yours for the same reason, in the sense that it felt like you were learning a lot, but it was through a story. And I just finished actually Bob Iger's the Disney CEO's book, and that was incredible as well. Like, he talked about meeting Steve Jobs, and you kind of almost felt like you were in the room as well. And he's got he reminds me a bit of you in the sense that he's very optimistic, he's very humble, and that was something that I really took from your book. Even listening to it, I really enjoyed hearing your story. So what we would love to see is what's on your bookshelf, because you've got obviously a very impressive bookshelf behind you.
On the spot.
Yeah, so if you could give us a look at what's actually on Mark Randolph's bookshelf, that'd be great.
Well, I have to apologize that most of my reading these days is on the Kindle, the Amazon Kindle.
Shout out to
My family are voracious readers, so we do churn through. So, and this is completely non-expected and unrehearsed, so I'm not sure what's going to happen.
But
I'm just going to change view, and we'll pull out four or five books at random.
Yes.
And we'll see what they are. Okay.
Amazing. We'll get to see your shorts as well.
Oh, God. No, that's embarrassing. Okay. First of all, disapprove that I am wearing shorts. There you go. Those muscular thighs. Okay. So we got here Jane Eyre, of course. Here's some Charles Dickens.
Oh, the classic.
Here's the Red Tent. I bet you read that. Some Ian McEwan. Frank McCourt. Love Frank McCourt. Tiz. You guys read that one?
That's no.
Over here. There I am. Awesome stuff. A lot of nonfiction. A lot of biography. I mean, up here, Ben Franklin.
Franklin, wow.
Abraham Lincoln.
Wow.
Here we go. Here's this one. I'm sure you guys have all read, haven't you? It's the Epic of Australia's founding.
Oh my God!
What's on my bookshelf? Here we go. This is on my bookshelf right now. Oh! I just happen to have this one on my bookshelf. That will never work.
There you go. Okay, I'll show you one more thing. Let's see if I can do this without nauseating everybody. All right, here we go. We're going up. You see up there on the top shelf, there's all those books with the red. That'll never work in about 15 different languages.
That's amazing.
Right.
Yeah, there you go.
What are you reading right now?
Oh, God, I'm reading self-helpy. Cal, what's his name? He writes about deep work.
which is about Cal Newport.
Yes, Cal Newport. I'm reading Cal Newport's Deep Work book because I've found that especially now that I'm trying to expand my platform, so to speak, that I'm engaged, you know, on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and responding to emails, that all of a sudden I'm not writing as much. All of a sudden I'm not producing as much content. I'm not doing the things that I really enjoy doing. And I'm struggling to try and get that back. So that's what I'm reading right now, is trying to get into that. And just coincidentally, I have the Robert Iger book queued up for next. So
you're going to love that. Absolutely. Yeah. Can I make a recommendation?
Please.
Listen to it, because it's him narrating. And I'd actually love to hear your thoughts on that, because the way, I don't want to spoil it for you, but the way it opens up, it was really unexpected for me. And I was like, wow, that really caught my attention. I'm going to keep, you know, I was really engrossed in it, and I pretty much, I think, binge listened to that in a weekend, but it was a very good book, actually, very good book.
It's really, I mean, it's funny because I don't listen to books on tape and for a stupid reason, but at the same time, if I could tell anyone, I'd say, listen to my book as a book on tape. Listen to every book as a book on tape if it's read by the author,
yes,
in my opinion. Yeah. Because when you're writing a book, especially if you're an amateur like myself, you write the way you talk.
Yeah.
You're reconstructing dialogue and so you write the way you talk. But written language is such a blunt instrument. I mean, you have is, for emphasis, you have exclamation points or bold, or you can use ellipses or that. It's, you're trying to recreate speech using type.
Yeah.
And it's mediocre at best.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you go and you sit in that little stuffy booth for 4 days in a row and you read your book. All of a sudden you go, oh my gosh, this is incredible, because this is this is how it was meant to be.
Yeah. Heard.
So anyway, I'm a big fan, but I don't listen to it because I'm trying desperately to also listen to podcasts. And so, especially with no commute anymore, who has time to sit on the couch just staring blankly with a headphone?
I'm with you on that one.
Yeah, exactly. Well, definitely, if you can, listen to Bob, because it's definitely worth it. Have you met him?
Who?
Bob Iger.
Bob Iger?
No, I have not, no.
Oh, yeah. I'd be interested to know what sort of person he's like in real life. But
me too.
Well, we could actually talk to you all day, but unfortunately we can't, because you've probably got a million things to do and probably engage in some deep work. So thank you so much for making this. Thank you so much.
We'll do it again. How about that? We'll find some other subject to riff on about.
I would love to. You can be a regular. Maybe it's like it's the Mark, Nick and Lisa show. We've got to get that started up. But thank you so much for your time today,
thanks,
Mark. You know, something that really always strikes Nick and I is that you're always so generous and you never feel like, you know, you're rushed and you've got to rush off to a million things. So we really appreciate you being so generous with us and our listeners.
It's genuinely a pleasure, and thank you really for letting me have the opportunity to chat with you.
Thanks for your time, I appreciate it.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to today's episode. If you like what you hear, which we hope you do, we would love it if you subscribed and left us a rating and review. And to say thank you, Nick has got a little surprise lined up for you.
Yes, I am going to bribe you. We have teamed up with our friends at Booktopia to give you 10% off our favorite business books. The discount code can be found in the show notes.
And if you ask extra nicely, I'm sure Nick will gladly fund the extra 90% off, so you can get the book for free.
Whatever it takes.
And if you're not sick of us yet, you can find all the links to our social channels in the show notes. And look forward to seeing you for the next episode.